Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to another episode of Item 13. This week, I am incredibly honored to have Chef Pierre Thiam, who so many of you will already know. He was born and raised in Senegal, now lives in the Bay Area, and has dedicated his entire food career to making West African cuisine and ingredients accessible to new audiences in the U.S. and beyond. He's executive chef and co-founder of Teranga, his acclaimed fast casual group of restaurants in New York City. Those who follow me on Instagram know that every time I'm in New York, I make a stop at Teranga. He's also co-founder of Ulele, a purpose-driven food business that makes African ingredients available to U.S. home cooks and restaurants, while also connecting smallholder farms in West Africa with the global food economy. And again, when we've had dining experiences, I always talk about Fonio, and we've had the pleasure of actually having Ulele sponsor a couple of events that I've helped to host with chefs in New York and beyond. So really, truly excited to welcome you to the show, Chef Pierre.
It's a pleasure to be invited. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And so I wanted to start with you telling us your origin story, if you will. So, like, how did you end up in food? And it's always interesting to me when I talk to African men in particular, because traditionally, you know, women are the ones that are in charge of everything food related when you go back home. And it's just whether you're in West Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, and I've lived in all sort of all of those places, you know, women are the holders of our food culture. And so I'm always interested to hear how African men in particular end up in the food space.
I guess I came to the realization that women been playing a game on us. They tricked us into making us feel like cooking is the thing we don't desire. I mean, all jokes aside, though, how did I get into cooking? I've always been into cooking. I never thought of cooking as an option, but I've always loved good food. You know, growing up in Senegal, you know, men are food experts without entering the kitchen ever. You know, we always have something to say about the food that mama prepared. And we appreciate the way they prepare the food too, because our food is fresh. You know, my mom used to go to the market every day. You know, it's like it was, you know, in Senegal, because it's coastal. When you eat fish, you know, it was caught yesterday or today. You know, so it's like, you know, it's not, so it's a quality that made me appreciate the food in a way that was really just natural without knowing that it was an option. I was growing up in Dakar. I was a student in physics and chemistry when I decided to come to the U.S. So I came to the U.S. with a student visa. Because in Dakar, we had figured out, we managed to have the university closed down. We were very political as students. We had a political movement, and we were going on strike forever that particular year. And the government decided to shut down the school system. And for many of us, it was either we stay and we start over in the food system, in the school system that's like very unstable, or we figure out a way to go and finish our studies. And that's how I really stumbled into this obscure college in Ohio and applied, and they accepted me. And I was like, okay, I went to the embassy and I got my student visa. Off I was to the U.S. and decided to stop by New York, because a friend of mine lived in New York, and he was a friend from childhood, but he had moved to New York a few months before me. And he was like, oh, stop by New York a couple of weeks and then take the bus to Ohio. And that was my plan. And I never made it to Ohio. I mean, 30 years later, I was still in New York. I had stumbled into the cooking world, and it's a whole long story, really, how that happened. But a New
Yeah.
York typical New York story, typical New
Yes.
York
It
story.
actually reminds me of like my own first trip to the US too, just like you. I came from Ghana too, and went to I ended up in my schools. I ended up in the Midwest too, but
Oh, wow.
my first stop was in New York, and this was years after you came to New York, but there was a blackout. And
Oh,
I don't know if
I
you
remember that
remember
too. Of course I do.
that.
I was a private chef uptown at the time, and I had to walk from uptown all the way to Brooklyn. Yeah, of course I
Yeah,
remember.
so I that was the night that I landed in New York. And so like
No.
everything was shut down. I was 18 or 19. I was
Oh
so confused because
boy.
I had a connecting flight. I didn't know what to do. We were stuck in the airport. Nothing was
No.
working. And I remember
Wow.
thinking, I left Accra where like we had a lot of blackouts, thinking
I know.
I'm
You're
coming
like,
to
wow.
America for constant electricity, and this happened. So I can relate a little bit to come to landing in New York and sort of having an unexpected experience. But unlike you, I ended up going to Wisconsin, where I ended up going to school. But you stayed in New York and got your first job in a restaurant, right?
Yep. I stayed in New York, but I was actually going back to Senegal. I hated New York. It was like just, that experience and just the fact that, I wasn't prepared for that. It was starting to get cold, and
Relatable.
I was broke, and that's not what I expected from America. I mean, Dakar was so much more fun and interesting and pleasant and civilized. I mean, New York in the 80s, late 80s was like the crack epidemic. You may have or have not heard about it, but it's like
Yes,
people
yes.
were strung in the street on drugs, and you had the AIDS epidemic as well. So you had AIDS and crack, and that
Oh.
was just that was my environment. That was just, it was awful and cold and gray and dirty. And so I had a return ticket. That's what I had, and I was like tempted to take it if a friend of mine who worked in a restaurant. And that restaurant was looking for a busboy. So a busboy is a job that doesn't require any qualification. That was my very first job ever. All I had to do was take the empty plates from the table to the kitchen, to the dishwasher. I had to refill the glasses of water. That was it, so that's what I did. And that changed everything. First of all, the first cultural shock, the second cultural shock, first of all, after New York, of course. The second one is arriving at that restaurant. It's a restaurant downtown in the village, right? It's called Garvin's. And that restaurant is only men in that kitchen. And I'm like, something is wrong here. Something is definitely wrong. It's like, I'm like, men can't cook. Why is these guys making this amazing food? And their food looks beautiful. And I'm like, wow, these guys are like, eventually they became my people. I became friends with the chef who liked to practice his French with me. I became chef with a friend with the dishwashers because I was always bringing stuff in the empty plates to their section. And my friend who recommended me the job was one of the dishwashers. So, I had my crew in the kitchen, and eventually the chef who knew I wanted to get extra shifts. I really just wanted to make money and get out of New York, either make it to Ohio or just figure out something. So he offered me a job in the kitchen. He's like, when you finish your dishwasher shift or your busboy shift, you can come and wash the dishes because we have dishes that stay at night after service. So you could be the one doing that. And I was like, okay. I mean, for me, extra hours, we get paid by the hours. That's great. That's all I wanted. And I, of course, hated that job. I mean, hated it with a passion. It was like, those guys, those dishwashers would leave me like the dirtiest, biggest pots and pans, the dirtiest. That was my thing. For I would have to wash them for a couple hours every night. But doing that was my entering the kitchen because, the dishwasher is always the first person in the kitchen to call when there's a prep guy missing. The dishwasher comes up and steps up, and they give him a knife and they teach him how to cut the onions or peel the potatoes or do things like this. So you start to have your knife skills right there. It's like that's just the progression of the kitchen. And the chef had he knew that he had told me that's how he became a chef, he went from the bottom up, and that's the tradition. That's the old school, you know. It's like many of them, that's something. So he wanted to coach me through that, and I was going along because to me it was, you know, it was a nice crew, but I didn't think it was if there was a future for me there, you know, especially, you know, washing dishes, pots and pans. I didn't see that going somewhere, you know, like where I'm here today.
Yeah, so, I mean, and that was going to be my next question. So for everyone that's listening who hasn't even heard your origin story before, I wonder then how do you draw that line from working in a French, I believe it was a French restaurant in Soho, to now doing specifically West African food, even Senegalese food. Where did that leap happen? What was the connecting dot?
Well, you know, it was exciting. I got to a point where I liked what I was doing. I got to a point where I became passionate about cuisine. You know, it's like, you know, it was fun. When you left the dishwasher job and now you're a prep guy and then you become a garde manger and eventually start growing up the kitchen ladder, then it becomes fun. It becomes interesting for me, particularly because of my background in chemistry. I could connect with what was happening in the kitchen. That really was something that I started to take this seriously. You know, and that's my joke earlier when I say women in Africa, they play the trick on us, because I, you know, that's a legit activity. I mean, it's like something that men should be able to do, and they, you know, but they, you know, that's our tradition, and they did it, and I'm grateful that they kept it going from generation to generation, mother to daughter, and that really is something that's very impactful. But to answer your question, how did I leap? Is I was in New York City now, this young kid who loved the food world, and I had the opportunity to work in different restaurants. From the French restaurant, I worked in an American bistro, and then I worked in an Italian restaurant, and then I worked in this restaurant in Soho that was serving Southeast Asian cuisine. And that's really where everything really started to connect for me. You know, I am like here in this place called the food capital of the world. You know, New York City was exciting. It was like, I mean, great chefs were here, you know, and now I'm like kind of seeing where the food is taking you. And I'm also wondering, where is African food in this picture? Yeah. You know, Africa was missing, you know, and I appreciated the food that I was cooking and I was tasting, eating. But I also was missing my flavors of home, you know, the those flavors of the mafé, the peanut sauce, the yassa with onion and lime and garlic and chilies and the jollof and all of this, you know. So yeah, you miss those flavors, and for me those flavors were really memories, you know, because again, I didn't even have those recipes, I didn't even, you know, cook when I was home, but I just know that every single day I had an amazing meal. Every single day, you know, either at home or at my neighbors or at my cousin, my aunt. I mean, that's how we do, you know. In Africa, we just, you know, we just serve food, and that the food is great. So anyway, I was missing that, and I saw this, you know, working in this Southeast Asian restaurant. I saw, you know, if this restaurant can do it the way they're doing it with the flavors that somewhat are similar to our flavors, because they do a lot of fermentation, they do a lot of acidity, I mean fruity and chilies and spices, and all of that is what we have, you know, in our cuisine, and the grains and all that. Like, you know, I'm going to look into that. And that became a mission, you know. Eventually at the restaurant, that restaurant was doing well, and I became a chef de cuisine. We opened a new location in Miami. I was sent there. But when I was doing that at the restaurant, I was served at family meal. I don't know if you know what family meal is at the restaurant.
For the staff,
family meal.
For the staff,
yeah. Every day before service, there's a family meal at like 4 or 5 o'clock. Everyone gets together, and one of the cooks prepare the family meal. And whenever that was my turn to prepare the family meal, I would go back to my memory, the dishes that my mom used to prepare. And this is what I would serve for family meal. And really reconstructing those recipes from memory. And that was just the best family meals for the staff. All the time, whenever I was doing family meals, people were like, wow, you know, why don't we serve it at the restaurant, and so on and so forth. No, so it was really like that confirmed to me that there was room for that. And New York was ready. New York was exciting. New York people were going to be going for that. I knew that for sure. So eventually I started a catering business. I kept the job at the restaurant, and I would do catering on the side, because my client at the catering was people from the restaurant, like patrons who like just had become my friends. And that catering turned into my very first restaurant. That was called Yolele as well, in Brooklyn, back in Bed-Stuy. Back in the days, Bed-Stuy was not what Brooklyn has become.
Right.
It was not gentrified
Right.
at all.
Like
So this
cool was
restaurant,
cool.
yeah, absolutely. I was a pioneer for sure. I was there in the street. I was on Fulton Street, but in the street where, there was no other restaurants, sit down restaurants with like a beer and wine menu and like, African at that too. I mean, people were like, who is this guy? People usually at that time they had restaurants like the Chinese restaurant with like the windows that had like bars in the window. So you have to come, you don't sit down, you just come and put your money through the window and you get your food. That was the kind of thing. Or McDonald's maybe. That was a sophisticated restaurant you would
Yeah.
have at the time. And here I am with this African bistro and I just serve like plantain, stuff like jollof and mafé and kelewele, you name it. My goal was always to also be about West African cuisine. I didn't want to call it Senegalese. I didn't want to. This was really intentional. I thought it was important that I, because those borders are not our borders. They're not real. Those
Right.
borders have been imposed upon us. So I really wanted this approach to be a decolonizing approach in a sense. So I would just go and restaurant, my restaurant in Harlem, Teranga. I mean, the food travels. It's not like specifically from Senegal, so I would have food from Cote d'Ivoire, from Ghana, from Nigeria, from Senegal, and
Yes.
that makes sense. That was so
Yeah.
that's when it started, and that restaurant became a destination. I had my first cookbook deal from that restaurant, and
The
that's
rest, as they say, is
never looked back.
history, right?
Never looked
Yeah,
back.
so that's a good segue to talk about your upcoming cookbook, Simply West African. So your previous cookbooks have been very specific, right? So you've had your Fonio cookbook, you've had Senegalese food specific cookbooks. And so it's really interesting to me, this idea. First of all, West African food in general, and I'm sure because you're in the space, seems to have gotten some sort of renaissance, if you will. We're seeing it, across all of the major food media. It's top 10, cuisines to follow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of that credit, I think, has to do with you and some of the other chefs, Kwame, Eric, et cetera, in the work that you're doing to bring our food to the forefront. And so, one, I want you to tell us about this new cookbook, the focus of it, and then let's have some discussion around regional food versus country specific. And we'll talk about the country specific foods too. But tell us about this cookbook that's coming up.
Yeah, so this cookbook for me, it's an important one. I just finished actually doing a series of photos with the photographer Evan Sung, who is the one who worked with me on Senegal. He's an amazing, world-class food photographer. And so we did a whole week of like photos. We had to do 80 recipes for the week,
Oh, wow.
and out of my home kitchen, mind you, because this is a book that's about it, more intimate. It's about me at home, me at home here in the US, in California, and I want the book to be more accessible. That's why I call it Simply West African, and the recipes are also more accessible. I want to break that myth that West African food is intimidating. Whenever you say Africa is intimidating to people here, because of the sad the relationship we've had over the centuries between Africa and Americas. So that's still a way for me to break that myth, is to make it more accessible. And that's why actually I have a restaurant like Teranga, which is, you come and you're less intimidated because you make your own bowl. You pick what you want in your bowl and it's like friendly. And so this book is that continuation. It's about that. I want the book to be someone in Kansas City or in Oregon
Cleveland.
can in Cleveland, exactly. So that person in Cleveland can take it and cook it on a Tuesday or Monday or Wednesday night, after work. Just not it doesn't have to be a special occasion to make African food. It can be every day. So that's part of the mission, to like really bring be a voice for this cuisine, for our food culture. And by making it more accessible this way, with recipes that are accessible but still fun, and then recipes that are actually delicious and beautiful, as you will see in the book, but accessible. So it really makes people gives people the opportunity to have like a delicious, healthy, because our food is healthy, you know, like very much plant-based. You know, obviously there's some protein, but our tradition is what I want to go to. That's where I found my inspiration throughout over the years, looking into as far back as I can go into the culinary tradition of West Africa and find gems, because they are like some amazing, amazing foods and recipes. And that's and then bringing them to a wider audience, and eventually, you know, making it in such a way that they can cook it on a Tuesday night after work.
Yes, I'm really excited for it, because this idea of making, and we can have this brief discussion about this idea of making our food accessible. So I've been doing this for quite a long time, and speak mostly to African or first gen immigrant Africans who are doing work in the food space. And we always have this discussion about the balance between making our food accessible, but at the same time, not losing the authenticity of it. You know what I mean? That it's not watered down in a way that, you know, my child or my grandchild would not be able to recognize it if they went to a different place. And so how do you think about that balance?
It's an important balance to keep. It's very important, because what we're doing is, you know, I like to say we are not chefs or cooks or anything. We are storytellers. Yeah, we are telling that story. We are the custodians of a food culture that's been passed upon us from grandmother to mother to daughter, and here we cannot break that chain. We have to make sure as we pass it on, with the integrity. We pass it on as the authenticity, as you're mentioning.
Yeah.
But again, you know, the ultimate goal is to access, you know, the ultimate goal is to access to a wider audience, you know, and that's what we are bringing, and that's why we're doing it accessible. You know, today we have ways that our ancestors didn't have access to. To make things differently, faster, easier, simpler, without losing the integrity of the food. It's very important. Like I said, again, we are storytellers, we are griots. We have to recognize that we are telling the story of not only these recipes, this food culture, these ancestors. We are telling the stories of these ingredients. We are telling the stories of how, you know, when you look at a plate, you are looking at a story. Because when each ingredient is telling the story, you know, from the farmers that grow it, and how did the farmers get to it? You know, how did this rice get to become, you know, the grain we use for jollof? You know, and then you go back and you see that there's like colonization was involved. You know, at some point, you know, we had our own rice, and then the French came and they brought this broken rice from Indochina, which it became Vietnam, because that was part of their colonial empire, because they wanted our farmers to grow peanuts. So that disrupted the approach we had on certain recipes. The colonization story comes through this. So you're telling a story, and you can go back deeper and deeper, and you can go talk about how, you know, our ancestors domesticated certain crops, you know, like fonio, and how come those crops are like so amazing and so resilient, and now those crops are just the future of food security if we figure out a way to integrate them in our system. So you're telling a story, but you're also projecting in the future as well.
And I think that the other piece of it, in terms of accessibility, like creating a bigger market for it from an economics perspective, like that connection back to farmers back at home, then creates a value chain that helps support, you know, whether it's farmers, you know, we talked about women being, you know, the bedrock of our food economy back home, like that accessibility to a wider audience also then creates opportunities for those back at home who are, who you've included pretty brilliantly, I think, and we can talk about that now in the value chain for Fonio in particular, and the work you're doing with Yolele. So maybe let's talk about that. So in terms of the work that you do with Yolele and Fonio, and for those that who've been listening to the podcast forever, I don't think we need to do a history of that, because I've talked about Fonio, I've talked about Yolele ad nauseum at this point. But when you think about that work that you do at Yolele, how is that then different from the work you do as a chef, as a cookbook author, and even, you know, as a restaurant owner? And how does that expand on that? Because I think about a chef like Selassie Atadika in Ghana, who has Midunu, who's focused on indigenous ingredients, who's also now creating her own think tank, if you will, the Midunu Institute, that's really focused on educating, creating that research around indigenous foods. And I think it's essentially on almost the same path as you've been. And so really interested in hearing your thoughts on like why you thought from the perspective of what you did at Ulele that it was important to do the education piece, the connection to the value chain piece, all of that.
Well, it was important in so many ways because, you know, like I said, you know, when I first had a glimpse of where this could go is from the realization that Africa wasn't included in the food capital of the world. And I was like, a lot of it is just because there's this miseducation. There's like these lies. There's so much, you know, people oftentimes, when I did my first cookbook, my very first cookbook, people oftentimes thought, you know, I got interviews with people asking me, well, I mean, we never thought of Africa as a continent that has abundance like this. You know, it's like because that's the media that's been portraying us this way. I mean, over the years, you know, Africa is like, you know, scarcity. Africa is people are dying of famine, you know, and all those kind of stories. And that's not my Africa. So it was important that, you know, that was the core of the mission. Eventually, with the restaurant, then the cookbooks. But when I did my second cookbook, I saw another challenge. You know, as I was writing the recipes, I always had to think of substitutions for ingredients, you know, because the ingredients that I was suggesting were not accessible in the market. You know, and that's when the idea of Yolele came to me. I was like, I have to figure out a way to make these ingredients accessible for them to really have an experience that's authentic. You know, how do you substitute fonio with couscous? You know, that would be the same size grains, but it's not the same experience at all. It's not even the same, nutritionally speaking. It's like completely different. I mean, you can't compare fonio. It's so delicate and light, and couscous, you eat it and you're heavy. But that's the kind of poor substitution that I had to propose because, I didn't have, my readers didn't have access to the ingredients. So the goal now was to figure out how to make those ingredients accessible. And then I started to think, now if I'm going to make ingredients accessible, it has to be ingredients that really have an impact on the small farming communities that are growing it, that have been growing it for generations. You know, it's only fair because they kept that tradition going. It's only fair that they are the ones who should be the ultimate beneficiaries, and particularly the women. You know, a crop like fonio is a crop that's like, they call it a women crop. They're the one who kept it going. It's a crop that's so difficult to process. And the women had to traditionally pound it to remove the skin. They had to pound it with a mortar and pestle for up to 2 hours to get only 1 kilo
Oh
of
wow,
fonio. So that was,
I didn't realize it was that manual.
yeah, it was manual until recently it became mechanized. And this is where we were able to take it to a bigger market. And even now, we have to have it completely mechanized. And we designed a mill that's a unique mill. That's a mill that will process fonio without any manual, and it will take it in a way that's revolutionary because we're contracting the farmers now, and then ahead of time, you know, pay them ahead of time, and then we take the fonio that's going to be processed with our mill at 2 tons per hour, as opposed to like 1 ton per day right now, which is the state of fonio processing. In addition to that, it will also reduce the waste. Because right now, even though there's some mechanization, there's 50% of waste, up to 50% of waste. So with the new mill, it's the waste is single digits. It's like it's gone. So that's an amazing way to like double the production without even growing more fonio. But we had to do that because the demand is growing now. You know, we launch our products. We started with fonio, our star product, and we launched one grain first. Like 5 years ago at Whole Foods, one Whole Foods. And eventually that grain did well. You know, it was a champion in this category. You know, personally, I had to go to the store and do some tastings, and do some cooking demos for
You did. You
yeah,
did
that's
go to. So if we had walked into Whole Foods back there in New York, we would have seen you.
that was me there making calling people and say, hey, you gotta taste this one, and I would make different ways. I would make fonio salads, stuff depending on the season. If it's a hot day in Harlem, I'll make fonio salads with like mango and tomatoes. I mean, stuff that I imagined. It doesn't have to be a traditional heavy dish. That's the great thing about this grain. It's a versatile grain. It can be adjusted in so many different ways. So this is what we did. And eventually Whole Foods saw that we were doing really well in that store, and they invited us to enter more stores. And today we are in all the Whole Foods in America, more than 500 stores. And then we have, in Target, we are, I mean, you name it. So we have a wide distribution nationwide, and we have added new products now. We have Fonio Pilafs, all inspired by the tradition of our cuisine, Jollof Fonio, Dawa Dawa Afro Funk, the greens with moringa and baobab, the Dakar curry. And now we entered the chips category. So we entered the snacks category with our chips. We
I
have
saw that.
Fonio chips. It's very, very exciting. They're delicious. They've been really talked about, it's getting really good media attention. And they also have different flavors. We have the tangy baobab, we have the plain sea salt, we have the yassa, which is lime and chilies, we have the Afro Funk. We have different chips. So we're going to keep growing and adding new products. And the snack is interesting because it's a fast moving category, and that's really exciting to see that happening.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I've been following your story. Like I said, been following the journey of Ulele for a while now. So it's been really interesting, especially from the product innovation perspective, to see the different things that you've been able to do with Fonio. Where do I want to go? First of all, we didn't cover how people can, when the cookbook is coming out and when where people will find it when it comes out.
Well, they'll find it at bookstores everywhere. It's my publisher is a Random House, Penguin Random
Oh,
House,
okay.
and so that's
When should we
I
expect it to come out then?
it's coming out next fall, actually, end of last summer, next summer, early next fall.
Okay.
So it's now it's finished. The manuscript is finished pretty much. The photos are taken, and now it's going to the design and the printing and all of that. And
Great.
it's strategic. They're timing the release so that it's the optimum right before the holidays and all of
Yes,
that.
I
So
was just going to say that sounds like a great time for the
yeah.
cookbook to come out.
But you have my other books right now in the market too, so you can
Yes.
go get them.
So
Yeah. So
there's the book on
there's
Fonio. There's
Fonio
the
Cookbook, there's Senegal Cookbook, there's Yolele, and
Yes.
those are like they are on Amazon. They can at Barnes and
And
Noble,
so
depending on.
in the show notes, I will share a link to all of the cookbooks that are available to Teranga, to Ulele, so that listeners can link directly to those and support the mission of Ulele, Teranga, and all of
Thank
that stuff.
you. Thank you.
And so as we start to wrap up here, usually for regular listeners, we usually wrap up with rapid fire questions, but I wanted to take advantage of the time we have with Chef Pierre, given the variety of people that listen that have their own African food businesses, right? So from a CPG perspective, for upcoming chefs, for people that are doing the work of storytelling in the food space, wanted to get like your final thoughts, advice, for having been in the industry for decades, not to age you, but wanting to say that you are experienced. And so what words of wisdom in the tradition of African people, like what listen taking words of advice from our elderly, again, not to age you, but saying that you
That's
have a
cool.
lot
That's
of
okay.
experience. You have a lot of experience. What final words of advice? Because it can be a tough business, right? Restaurant alone has its
Yeah.
challenges. Getting into stores,
Absolutely.
getting into Whole Foods. I mean, you made it sound like it was an easy, but it's tough to get on shelves, right? So what final words of advice do you have for young people, especially who are trying to break through, especially coming from the continent or being first gen and really trying to tell the story of our culture through food?
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's. home of Heritage Radio Network, for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I think what kept me going was, one, because I was very naive. You know, I'm like, this is one of my traits. You know, I think I can do anything. And I think I realized it once I'm in it, that, you know, it's like not so easy. You know, you have to, you know, I'm like, I can turn Fonio into a world-class crop, right? Mm. And then you realize that there's like a whole chain of value that you have to build, you know. So all of that, just to say that being that naive and dreamer is really what one important quality that keeps you going. Having that passion for what you're doing is those kind of things you have for you that no other challenges can shake if you really have a true passion for what you're doing. And that's important in the food world. Food is passion. Food is more than just a, you know, commodity. Food is a culture. Food is, you know, bridging cultures. It's sharing. It's, you know, all of those values that we have in Africa. You know, integrate them in your business, in your approach to the business, and have that as the North Star. To me, was you know, I wanted to be a voice for African cuisine. So whatever I'm doing, it has to be taking me to that goal, and that's it, you know. And I'm confident that I get the blessings from the ancestors, because all I'm doing is getting inspiration from them. All I'm doing is looking back and getting recipes from them, looking for ingredients that they passed upon me. So I'm just telling their story. I'm just taking it from them. There's like a deep well that's like an ending of like knowledge that's been, of traditions that's been there, for us to find inspiration and then, you know, and then go for the world and dream big, because, you know, why not, you know, and especially when it comes to us, you know, not only why not, but it's a necessity, you know. This Yolele is like is a model of development. That's what I see it to be. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just a brand, it's a brand, because it's important that, you know, the realization that we needed to brand our products. We are in a market economy, so this is, mm-hmm, this was a way to do it, and see it as a, you know, so that it has an impact in the communities, back home in Africa, in the rural regions of Africa, and then, you know, you bring economic opportunities, you bring jobs, you bring, you know, things that, you know, a decade ago they were just growing fonio to eat at home, you know, subsistence. And now they become exporters of food. Now they become, you know, they have a people contracting them a year ahead. They're getting paid. They're getting, you know, support. And the communities are striving. And that's the model of development that I want to offer. And I think many of us, when we enter this world of food, we can duplicate that. You know, there are lots of products that are out there, lots of ways of it can be, either from the way you present your food at a restaurant, if you're a chef, or the way you, you know, your CPG, how you put your product out there, you know, brand it in a way that tells a story, and make it sexy, make it fun, and just have fun. Have fun. It's very important. Have fun. Be passionate about what you're doing.
Yes. All of this resonates with me, and I'm thinking about specific examples of, you know, chef friends that I have who are Ivorian or from Zimbabwe or, you know, different other places on the continent. And I know that they are listening and that they will take a lot from what you just shared. Dream big, follow the voice of ancestors, and have fun while you're doing it too. Thank you so much, Chef Pierre. It's been an absolute honor to chat with you today. I can't stop saying, like, you're an inspiration to me and to so many others who are trying to do the work in the space of, like, you even said, of storytelling, telling a story. And we hope that the work we're doing translates to some form of economic support, sustenance, if you will, for people back home. And so I appreciate
it. It has to be sustainable. It has to be sustainable. You know, you have to get paid. That's important. So don't forget to get paid. You know, just like otherwise, you know, there's no, as passionate as you are, you know, it's just going to be, you know, it's not sustainable.
Yeah,
so, you know, it's an opportunity to sorry.
I said that's a really important point, that it's not just the passion.
Yeah, it's a business. It's a business. You have to remember that it's a business. Keep it as a business. Be clean. Be you know, be organized. That wasn't my strength. You know, but you know, you surround yourself with the right people, and you see what you bring, and you see what you're missing, and bring those people that are missing, and that's how you know. That's how you make it a sustainable business.
Great. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time and all of the work that you're doing in this space. Thank you.
Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.